accession number 11767, rail 3.
Admiral Mills, rail 3.
My job was to look at the house and its location and to advise as to whether I thought it could be suitable for Admiral Ramsay's headquarters for the invasion. When I arrived at the navigation school, I was met with some quite angry people who were appalled at the idea of this being taken over as someone else's headquarters. Anyway, they kindly showed me around, showed me what there was and all the rooms, and I went back and reported that from the point of view of the communications, and as far as I could see, it would be suitable for the headquarters. There was plenty of space if any more Nissen huts or tents or anything were required. Plenty of rooms in the house. I thought there was rather a lot of glass about against air raids, but I think that was the only possible criticism. And in due course, when others had been there as well, of course, it was decided upon as the headquarters, and that was where we moved to shortly before the invasion. It's quite interesting in the aftermath now that whereas when I went there, they seemed unable to produce any drawings of the building, and they didn't like the idea of being taken over, but now, of course, there's tremendous pride taken in the fact that that was the headquarters, and there are diagrams up where people can go and see the routes of the convoys across the channel. It is, in fact, now a naval tactical school. But it was interesting, the change, whereas before there was considerable opposition, in the aftermath there was great pride in the purpose to which it had been put.
What were the Americans like to work with?
They were very good. Very good, very, very cooperative and helpful. They tended to be fairly independent, and of course their security regulations were very strict, as they always have been, and probably still are today. And for instance, there was one room where they had some of their secret ciphering machines. Well, not even Admiral Ramsay himself was allowed to look inside, let alone any of us. But they were very, very cooperative and helpful. They were sometimes a little bit wild and dangerous with plans, and I think that we in our forces would have been very embarrassed to have the American resources because they were so great, but I'm equally certain that they could never have got by with our resources. I think we had to have much more guile than they needed because of the resources which they had at their disposal. One example, perhaps, when I think I use the word clumsy sometimes, just after the invasion fleet had sailed, when the operation was finally turned on, I went into their communications room, not the one with the secret cipher machines in it, but into the operational communications room, and I leant over the shoulder of one of their operators, and I noticed that he was actually calling one of their ships, which was in the channel. Well, of course, this was the most awful thing to do, because the operation depended on very strict radio silence on the part of the ship, so that they did not transmit Morse by radio, to thereby helping the enemy even more, both to pinpoint them and perhaps to tell them what they were saying. And I found to my horror that here was this operator trying to get in touch with the ship. Well, I got the duty officer and stopped him, of course, because as I explained earlier on, everything from the shore to the ships went in a form in which it didn't have to be answered.
What do you remember about D-Day itself?
D-Day itself, I remember being at the headquarters at Southwark Park, waiting for messages to come back after they had landed. Of course, they sailed at night, and I remember, I suppose, one of the chief things that I remember is that at that time it happened my wife and I were in the process of getting engaged, and when we were both off duty during the evening when the invasion fleet sailed, we just went out for a little walk into Southwark Park, and it was the most wonderful warm summer's evening. And then I remember the sort of eerie silence of it all, looking across the channel. Well, we couldn't, of course, see the ships, but they were all blackened out. But we knew what there was there and where they were going. We'd both been in the signal staff and knew it all. The actual decision itself is something I remember, because you may recall that the operation was postponed, first of all, because of the bad weather. And it could only be postponed for one, or at the very most 2 days, and after that we've had to wait a whole fortnight before the conditions of tide came right again. And after the first postponement, there was, of course, tremendous further gathering of as much weather information as could be gathered. And I remember that it was my lot to take in one of the weather reports. We had ships out in the Atlantic, of course, and things reporting the weather. And it was my duty to take into the room where the commanders were meeting to decide whether or not to turn on the invasion. And I think it must have been about between 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning. And I went in this room to give to my admiral, who was the chief of staff to Admiral Ramsay, this weather report from one of the ships. And they were all in there, just preparing to sit down at the table. And I remember being very impressed with General Eisenhower sitting there on a sofa, having a cup of cocoa, smiling at everyone and saying good morning and looking utterly relaxed. And there he was about to be faced with this tremendous decision which he was about to take, because one of the reasons why it was so difficult was that he had to decide in the first instance to put the operation off when the weather was good with us, because of the weather that he was told was coming, and indeed it came. And then he had to decide when the weather was bad with us, but forecast to be good for the landing, to put the operation on.
Did D-Day go off as well as you had expected?
I think D-Day went very much according to plan, really, yes. I think one's feeling about it, and certainly mine, having been for nearly 9 months mixed up with the planning of it, knowing what was going to happen, one's feeling was one of absolute relief that it seemed to be happening without too much enemy interference. Of course, there was opposition, as is well known, but at least from the messages that we were getting, the convoy seemed to be getting across, and all seemed peace and quiet up to a certain point, and there's a curious feeling, I think I probably had it with the Algiers landing as well, that when you've been mixed up with something, you can't understand why the enemy is not expecting it more than he actually is and is prepared for. And here we were in the beginning of June, and I'd been mixed up with this since the previous September. And the tremendous feeling of relief when it actually happens, and you can then, although of course we were still sworn to secrecy about the operation as a whole, but at least it gradually becomes more normal to talk about where they were going to land and where they did land, and how it had all come off. There were some uncomfortable, perhaps, and worrying moments during the planning to go back a little to when I was in London, but the accommodation was sometimes difficult. I used to try and get a room in my club and couldn't always do that, and I wasn't billeted anywhere in London, and I had to find room somewhere, and sometimes I had to go along to somewhere like the annex to the Park Lane Hotel and try and find a room there. And I remember one night when I was actually put in to share a room, the only room I could find in London at that time and all the air raids and things. I was put in to share a room in the, I think it was the annex to the Park Lane, with a Frenchman. And here we were planning to land in Normandy, and I was always a little scared as to whether I might talk in my sleep or anything about what was going on. There were times like that, you know, but as I say, when the landing actually took place and then took place successfully, great relief and joy, of course.
What were your own duties after the landings?
After the landing, I stayed at the headquarters at Southwark Park, when, of course, the communications became more and more active, really. Up till the time of the landing, it had been mostly planning, and after the landing, it became live communications backwards and forwards, which we had to keep going and keep all the lines open and get to all the signals through, which of course were pretty considerable. And I stayed there in the headquarters, still as the assistant to the commander who was in charge of all the communications. I did one journey across the channel about 2 weeks after the landing, I think it was, when a very strong wind, a near gales, blew up about a fortnight after we had landed. And I went because one of the admirals on the staff went, and they wanted a signal officer to go. And Winston Churchill was going over, and some of the chiefs of staff from London, and I went in over in the ship from them. And it was interesting because it was very rough when we got to the beaches, and the only things going backwards and forward between the ships and the beach, just for the short time that we were there, were these things called ducks, which you may remember. They were D-U-K-W. I can't remember what it stood for now. It stood for something, but they were known as ducks. And they were these amphibious craft which floated in the water, and you could then drive them up the beach. And they were the only things going to and fro the ships, just for a short time.
Can you tell me how you came to go to the Far East in the last stages of the war, please?
Yes, then I... When I had finished at the headquarters at Southwark Park, I was appointed as the flag lieutenant to the admiral commanding what was the aircraft carrier squadron number 21, the 21st aircraft carrier squadron, which consisted of the carriers, they were known as Woolworth carriers, the carriers that we got from America. They were small aircraft carriers which we used for aircraft in support of landings. And I joined Royalist at Alexandra. As a matter of fact, I flew to Cairo and joined her at Alexandra, where she had some of these, they were known as assault carriers, with her. Royalist herself was a cruiser with a mass of wireless sets, an enormous number of communication lines. And she was a cruiser which had the admiral and his staff on board. And I was sent to become flag lieutenant and staff signal officer to this admiral, who was Admiral, as he subsequently became, Sir Geoffrey Oliver. When I first joined, he was only a commodore, and then he was promoted admiral a little bit later on. He was a very young admiral indeed to be promoted. I remember taking him a signal, which came in the middle of the night, and I had to go and wake him up, and it was a personal signal which came to him from the First Sea Lord, who at this time was Andrew Cunningham, and this was a personal signal congratulating him on being promoted to admiral. And I remember I woke him up in the middle of the night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, with this. We were in Trincomalee in Ceylon at the time, and he said to me, he said, this can't be right. It must be a corrupt group somewhere. Anyway, I joined the ship at Alexandra, and almost at once we sailed through the Suez Canal and went on to Ceylon, which was our base at Trincomalee. And we were going across the Bay of Bengal, and the aircraft at that time were attacking some Japanese bases and airfields in Sumatra. And while we were doing these operations, we were also planning and training for what was known as Operation Zipper, which was to be the landings in Malaya, as it was then called. And in fact, as you probably remember, these landings never came off because we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima in August of 45. And that finally ended the war, so we didn't have to do the landings. But that was to be our role. We had varying numbers of these assault carriers, 8, and then it built up to 10, I think it was. And we were going to support the landings. And that's what our aircraft and our pilots were trained for, to support amphibious landings or to attack airfields or ground troops or whatever.
What did you think to these rather scratch carriers?
they were certainly scratched, but they were very useful ships indeed, and on the whole they were very reliable, and they were adequate for the type of aircraft that they were flying. I mean, they weren't necessarily the latest fighters or anything, but they were good assault aircraft, and they were good for the job, and we were glad to have them.
What was the morale in the Navy about having to continue the war after the German surrender in the Far East?
Oh, it was still good, because by this time we, and being based on Ceylon, were completely tuned into the fact that the war was against the Japanese and the fact that the European war had come to an end more or less passed us by, and we just got on with the job that we were doing before, and we had always expected to have to go on and defeat the Japs as well, and so there were no problems about morale at all. One perhaps amusing incident, and at the same time rather unfortunate instance, was that you remember that VE Day was, I think, the 8th of May in 1945, and it happened on that morning. We were sailing for exercises and then to drop some bombs on Sumatra. And just after we'd sailed on this morning, a signal came from the captain of one of the destroyers to my admiral, asking him what he was going to do about a certain signal that had been received from the Admiralty. Well, when this came in, the signal from this destroyer, I had to try and find the signal that he referred to, and I couldn't find it at first, and it wasn't one of the ones that had been served up to me by the staff during the night to show to the admiral. Anyway, I found it in the end, and it said that VE Day was to be celebrated on the 8th of May. And here we were on the 8th of May, and we hadn't seen this signal or made any preparations for celebration or anything. We were proceeding on our normal exercises with the ship. And what had happened was that one of my wireless operators down below in what was called the main wireless office, which was way down in the bowels of the ship as opposed to some of the other tactical wireless offices that I had nearer the bridge, he had received this signal and for one reason or another thought perhaps it wasn't very important, and he just sort of filed it away instead of having it pass through. And so here was this sad telegraphist who a couple of days later had to be punished, I'm afraid, for not passing on the signal which declared a VE Day. But of course he wasn't punished very severely, but it was very difficult for the admiral because he had suddenly to alter the formation and to stop the particular exercise we were doing so ships could have a little celebration and of course make some appropriate signals about the European war to the ships and how we were continuing to fight on against the Japanese.
What did you think to the job as a flag lieutenant?
I enjoyed it very much, of course, because in peacetime the flag lieutenant has a great many social duties and endless parties or seating plans or whatever to arrange, but in wartime not so much of that and more of the operational side and attending on the admiral. And my admiral was a marvellous man, Admiral Oliver. He was one of these admirals who was always a jump ahead of anybody else. And I could see papers sometimes going round the staff, and they'd go all round the staff and various comments would be made, and then the paper would reach the admiral and he would write on it, "What about so-and-so?" And this was usually something that everybody else had missed. And it was a great joy to serve a man like that. He was very, very kind. And it seemed to me sometimes almost embarrassingly polite to me and to almost everyone else who came. Much loved by the sailors. Many people would have followed him anywhere. A tremendously hard worker. I had great difficulty ever getting him away from the ship. We had one spell in Trincomalee of a few days when there wasn't very much for him to do, and the captain and I made a plan to try and get him away from the ship for a little 24-hour or 48-hour break. It was very difficult to achieve, but I did in the end. He was a very keen fisherman. We stayed with some relations of mine, took him to Nurela, where he dangled a rod in the ditch. Didn't catch anything, of course, but if you're a real fisherman, that doesn't seem to matter.
What did you feel about the Japanese as an enemy as compared with the Germans?
They were, of course, very much more remote from us. We never got very close to them. In my service out there, we didn't. I was never in the Pacific. I think we probably developed a great hate against them, but obviously not so much of a hate of perhaps the soldiers who were much closer to them than we were. And not coming up against them, we didn't have any opportunity to form an opinion, really, of their ships at all. being, as I say, based on Ceylon, and they were nowhere near. The nearest we got to them was when we were out at sea on one occasion when one of our aircraft sighted an enemy cruiser, a Japanese cruiser, just up north of Sumatra, off the coast of Malaya. There was a little bit of intelligence about this beforehand, but it was by no means certain. But anyway, one of our aircraft spotted this, and we were then able to detach four destroyers who went and carried out a highly successful torpedo attack and sank the Japanese cruiser. But that was a long way away from where we actually were, and that in fact was the nearest contact that we had with them until it came to the surrender. And after the surrender, immediately after the surrender, we went to Singapore, where I went ashore with my admiral, and we were outside the building where Admiral Mountbatten accepted the surrender, and we saw them all going in, and we saw him inspecting the guard and thing at the time, and we were immediately outside the building, inside which he accepted the surrender from the Japanese. That was the end of the war as far as we were concerned.
What opinion, how was Mountbatten regarded in the Navy at that time?
Oh, he was regarded with great esteem because he was a great leader. There has, of course, been a great deal of criticism of his thing over certain things, but what leader or senior officer hasn't had criticism? But he was a great leader. He was in total command. He was the supreme commander, and he was in total command of all the forces out there, held in very high esteem, and was extremely good at talking to the troops of whichever service he happened to be talking to at the time. When he came to visit the fleet, which he did with us once in Trincomalee, he was obviously held in very high regard by all the sailors, who were extremely pleased to see him, and of course he was extremely good at...